Red Eye is 3 hours of alternative politics and culture, broadcast live from 9 until noon every Saturday morning on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver, Canada. Here's Jane Williams. Joe Wilding returned from Iraq 2 weeks ago. It was her third trip in 4 years. She spent 6 months there, this time as a member of Circus to Iraq, bringing circus to children in Iraqi schools and refugee camps. She also spent a few days in Fallujah doing ambulance work during the siege of the city. Joe Wilding spoke last night in Vancouver as part of the We Are Everywhere book tour, and she joins me on the line this morning. Good morning, Joe.
Morning.
Why did you go to Fallujah?
We were in Baghdad, several people who had been working there for some time, and the stories were coming out that medical aid was not getting in, that civilians were being killed, that ambulances were being shot at, and our Iraqi friends felt that as internationals, as foreigners, we would be able to escort a bus with medical aid supplies, we'd be able to escort ambulances, that kind of thing, and that we'd be less likely to be shot at because we were foreigners. And that's kind of the same thing that happens in Palestine, that internationals accompany ambulances and they're less likely to be shot at. And although it seemed like a bit of a frightening thing to do, it also seemed like we couldn't not do it. If we were so close to Fallujah and we might be able to help save lives, then we really ought to go.
What did you find when you got there?
Well, Fallujah was really devastated. The main hospital had been closed down by the American troops. The second hospital was still operating, but the road to it was controlled by American snipers. The Iraqi drivers referred to it as Sniper Alley. Electricity had been cut to the whole town as collective punishment, which meant that people had no power but also no water. There were no shops open. There were people trapped in their houses in American-held parts of town because they couldn't leave because of sniper fire. So they had no food, no water, no access to medical help, nothing at all. And we traveled around in ambulances. We were on one occasion trying to reach a pregnant woman who had gone prematurely into labor. And this is what we'd been doing for the rest of the day, was going in the ambulances and picking people up. And that had been okay. The doctor came out and asked us to go and try and pick up this woman, and it was already starting to get a bit dark, but we agreed to go and get her because she was giving birth at home and having problems. As we drove through the American-held part of town in a clearly marked ambulance, there was a shot fired at the ambulance. We waited thinking, well, they'll realize that this is just an ambulance and they'll let us pass. We stopped and we came under sustained fire from the Marines on the rooftop and lost the two front tires, so that by the time we got back to the hospital, to the clinic, we couldn't use the ambulance anymore. The two front wheels had been destroyed. And the doctors said to us, well, but we'd already repaired it four times before you took it out, so don't feel bad about it. It was a clearly marked ambulance, and at least one bullet hit the body of the ambulance. I'm not sure how many, because it was already full of bullet holes.
Did you see evidence when you were there of unarmed civilians being shot?
Yeah. We'd only been there about 5 minutes at the clinic when a family came in. Two children and an old woman had been shot. The two children both had bullet wounds to their heads. And the family said that they had been leaving their home in an American-held part of the town to flee to Baghdad, which is what a lot of families were trying to do, and that they had been shot by U.S. snipers. There was another elderly woman came in almost the same time, still holding a white flag, and she'd been shot in the abdomen. Her son said that, again, they'd been trying to leave the house, and she'd been shot by a U.S. sniper. The second day that we were there, we'd been asked to go and pick up some sick people from a house just in no man's land, where the Marines controlled the area from the rooftops which they were firing from. And we'd gone, we called out to the Marines and asked them, could we go to the house? Eventually they signaled that we were allowed to go to the house and they wouldn't shoot at us. And there was an old man lying face down in the road. He'd been shot in the back, and you could tell he'd been shot in the back because the entry wound in his back was clean, was small, but the exit wound in his chest was enormous. He'd been shot through the back. He was unarmed, and his son had not been able to come out of the house to get his body even because of the sniper fire. So when we came along, they came running out and they were screaming that he'd been unarmed. He'd just come to get the vehicle to take the sick people to the clinic. And I didn't see it happen, but their account of it was clear. And the evidence was that he'd been shot from the rooftop where the Marines were. So there was a lot of evidence that they were shooting unarmed civilians, but also that they were bombing civilian houses. People said that their neighbor's house, people that had fled to Baghdad told us about their neighbor's houses being bombed and 20 or 25 people being shot, being killed in a single house.
Now, when you left the city, you tried to negotiate with U.S. troops at the checkpoint. What were you trying to get them to allow people to do?
Well, there was a huge queue of people trying to leave the town because, as I said, they were trapped in their houses with no food, no water, no medical care. If they could get out, they were trying to get out to Baghdad. And yet the checkpoint had been closed. The Americans were firing what they said were warning shots, but obviously designed to prevent people leaving through the checkpoint or approaching the checkpoint. So we went and we negotiated with them that they would let all the women and children out. They were initially saying that no men of what they called fighting age were allowed to leave. So that meant all of the drivers of the cars, because most of the women don't drive. So we managed to negotiate with them that one man of fighting age, i.e. anything from mid-teens up to late 40s, would be allowed to leave if he was the driver with his family. And that still left a lot of people trapped in the town, but at least it meant that people were able to get out.
When you were talking to the troops at the checkpoint there, what was their response to people's fears in the town that once women and children left, that then something terrible was going to happen to the men there?
Well, the troops, it was quite apparent that the troops that we spoke to at the checkpoints had ceased to see the Iraqi people as human, certainly had ceased to see the people of Fallujah as human. So we heard troops say things like, "I like Fallujah, I killed a bunch of people there." That wasn't quite the word he used, but this is radio, so I won't. But when we were at the checkpoint, we were saying to them that these were men who didn't want to fight, who wanted to leave the town. And the response, I suppose, from a military point of view, it makes sense that you don't want people to leave and then risk that some of them will come back in behind you. But one of the soldiers said, oh, we want to keep them all there because we can kill them all more easily.
Who was doing the fighting in Fallujah?
In my experience, it was the people of Fallujah. It was ordinary people who lived in the town. We spent quite a lot of time with them in the end for one reason or another, and the men that we spoke to were local people. They were people whose families had been killed. One man said to us, my brother's son was killed, my brother was killed, my sister's son was killed. His best friend had been killed that morning. He had been wounded in the leg and therefore out of the battle, and the US soldiers came right up to him and slit his throat. And these were just people who belonged in the town of Fallujah, and they said to us that the tribal structure in Fallujah is very strong and it would be difficult for any foreign fighters to fit into that. And they were decentralized groups. It wasn't a single kind of, this is Mujahideen command. It was all different groups around the place. But as well, you have to realize that most men in Iraq have been in the military at some point because there's compulsory military service. So they've all learned to fire a gun. They've all learned basic military training. And then, you know, there were a lot of people that then left the army, bribed their officers and left the army because they didn't want to be in it. But there are a lot of people who have at least had basic military training around Iraq and in Fallujah.
No, there was a lot of solidarity with the people of Fallujah from the towns surrounding. And you said last night that solidarity was an alien concept under Saddam Hussein. Can you explain why that was?
The dictatorship was very brutal, and the sanctions created a huge amount of poverty, and so people were really struggling for just the very basic things in life. And the story that I was telling last night, which I think illustrates it best, is that it was illegal under the old Iraqi government to have a satellite dish. And so if people were caught with an illegal satellite dish, they either went to jail for 6 months or they paid a 300,000 dinar fine. And two-thirds of that fine went to the person that reported you for having the illegal satellite dish. The 300,000 dinar is about, in US dollars, about $130. So this was a huge amount of money for Iraqi people. If your business had collapsed or your job had disappeared because of the sanctions, which a lot of jobs had, and you had no other income apart from your food ration, that was a vast amount of money. And people's children were dying for lack of basic medicine. Like, diarrhea was the biggest killer of children under the sanctions. So things like that made it difficult for people to make that choice between betraying their neighbor and taking the money, or watching their children die, or perhaps sending their children to school because they couldn't afford the money, the shoes, the backpacks, or the kids had to work on the streets to earn money. So the sanctions really created the currency for that divide and rule policy that Saddam was already so good at. And it meant that people were afraid of their neighbors. They would still give their neighbors anything. You know, they would give them their last egg, but they wouldn't trust them. And so when I was first there 6 months ago, you would talk about solidarity with Iraqis. And there's a word for it that exists in their language, but the concept just doesn't. And so that's really has been hampering the rebuilding of civil society. And so I think, although Fallujah was appalling, people said things like, Fallujah is Iraq and Iraq is Fallujah. And it really brought people together much more than anything has in recent time.
Several people last night spoke about how the atmosphere in Iraq had changed since the war first started. What's the difference now with when the U.S. troops first went in terms of how the Iraqi people see the situation?
Well, I mean, there were always people that didn't want to get rid of Saddam, and there were always people that did. And those who did, people who have been so brutalized by Saddam, even if they didn't want the war to happen, even if they didn't want to be bombed, they were still willing to give the U.S. troops and the coalition troops a chance to deliver something better, to make their lives better. And they were prepared to wait and to be patient. And that meant that they would put up with a lot. And now that they've gone through so much, they've seen in Sadr City, for example, Thawra, which used to be called Saddam City. This is a huge Shia district, very poor, of maybe 2.5-3 million people. It's about half of the population of Baghdad, although nobody really knows because there's not been any census information. And in this area, they welcomed the Americans. They gave them cigarettes. They gave them flowers. They were fine, you know, walk the streets, no problem. And now they've killed a lot of civilians in just unprovoked attacks. There was one time where there had been shooting from some general area, and so the Americans came in with tanks and just strafed the entire area, killed people still inside their houses. And those kinds of stories are just commonplace, coming out of Thawra all the time. They bombed al-Sadr's office several times, in addition to closing down his newspaper, which hadn't actually threatened any violence against the U.S. at that point, had fairly small circulation at that point, and they created this kind of hero martyr figure out of al-Sadr, who had previously been quite a marginal figure. And so they've just kind of perpetrated this series of disasters and attacks on civilians and attacks on the rights that they thought they were being given. And it's really changed things. People have started to think, the Americans are not better than Saddam. In fact, a man in Sadr City actually said that to us, the Americans are no better than Saddam, which really seems like an astounding turnaround when you think that they were once welcomed there. How did they manage to wear out such a welcome?
Now, the work that you went to Iraq to do was to present circuses to children. Why circus? Why circus in a situation like that?
I actually had a whole range of projects, including oral history, just telling people's stories because they hadn't been getting out, and setting up links between schools, hospitals, universities and such like in order to, for example, to rehabilitate the university libraries because under sanctions they weren't able to get any books or any CDs or any journals in. So the idea was to set up a whole load of links between people in Iraq and in the UK so that those things could be rebuilt. But the circus, the point was that although the physical reconstruction is very important, they also need a whole healing process to go on because people have gone through so much trauma. The leading child psychologist in the country says that there's probably not a single child in Iraq that's not suffering from some degree of post-traumatic stress. That manifests in a lot of different ways, including things like bedwetting, lack of concentration, chronic anxiety, aggression, a whole array of different things. And so the idea of the circus was that we would work with the traumatized kids in the refugee camps and the squatter camps, the schools, the hospitals, the theaters, the youth centers, whole range of places where you find a lot of children. And it worked really well because it turned out that it wasn't just the children that needed to play and needed healing, it was the adults as well. And so we had, sometimes the adults would come and join in with the games, they'd come and join in with the parachute games, and play with us. The teachers were saying to us that when you gave the kids drawing materials before the circus came along, they would draw aeroplanes bombing houses and tanks firing missiles. And after the circus came, they'd draw clowns and magicians and jugglers, and people's heads, adults as well as children, had their heads so full of violent images that it took something really vivid like the circus to displace that as the most immediate thing in their minds. And so what we actually achieved with it was just to begin a healing process, to give the kids something else in their imaginations. We talked to a woman down in Nasiriyah in the south. She worked in a youth centre and she'd been going around for a couple of weeks before the circus came, talking to the girls' families, going to their schools, and reassuring the parents and persuading them to let the girls come out, because at that point only three girls were using the youth centre and those girls were only using it for sewing lessons. So the girls were not doing anything, they were suffering from developmental delays as a result of the lack of physical activity, you know, poor spatial awareness, poor motor coordination, so they were unable to develop things like handwriting, very basic stuff. And after the show, she said that she'd still been surprised to see so many of the girls there. And she said, I haven't seen these girls smile since the war. It makes me think there's still hope. And it was the starting point for them using the youth centre more and starting to come out more. So the circus had a whole array of effects that you wouldn't necessarily expect, but it was a very positive thing.
For people here who are so removed from the situation and wonder what kind of actions and what kinds of protests could be useful, what would you say to them in closing?
I think there's a huge amount of things people can do, things like trade union solidarity. If people are in trade unions here, the Iraqi people need their support. Trade unions there are facing a lot of interference and a lot of obstruction with setting up. The companies which are taking the reconstruction contract are abusing the Iraqi workers. They're also taking a huge amount of money to do very little. Bechtel, for example, takes a $40,000 contract to rehabilitate a school and subcontracts immediately for about $25,000. The work done is then subcontracted again and done very poorly. Companies like that, we need to take them on. There's a lot of information on the internet about the companies that are now operating in Iraq, and we can go to their offices and make it clear that profiting from Iraq's devastation is not appropriate. I think there's a whole load of things that we can do within our own communities, and that's the thing with the We Are Everywhere book tour. It's worked really well. David and I, who have just come back from Iraq, traveling with two of the co-editors of the book, because it's full of all these stories from activists all over the world who have done things within their own areas. People in farmers in India, women campaigning against dams in India, people in Bolivia trying to get just basic water supplies, people in South Africa setting up to make sure people throughout their communities are connected to basic services, all of those kinds of things. And it's been really inspiring to see that you don't have to go. Going to Iraq was very useful and very positive, but there's so much that you can do just at home. And you sometimes feel like everything you're doing is not enough in Iraq and anywhere else. And so the book has a whole load of stories about how people have brought about change just by carrying on doing all of these things. And so I think that's really the thing that people can do, is just to organize within their own communities, change their own lives, fight things like the arms trade. Those demonstrations are really important, and people in Iraq know about them. They see them. If you go on a huge demonstration, people in Iraq see it, and they feel less alone as a result of it. But also, it's all of the stuff that you can do at home for healthcare and for education and for your own rights here.
Thank you very much for speaking with me this morning, Jo.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Jo Wilding. She spoke last night as part of the book tour for We Are Everywhere, The Irresistible Rise of Anti-Capitalism. If you'd like to find out more about the book, you can go to weareeverywhere.org, and you can read Jo Wilding's writings from Iraq at wildfirejo.blogspot.com. You've been listening to a program produced by Red Eye, an alternative media collective which broadcasts every Saturday morning from 9 until noon on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM, in Vancouver, Canada.